This is our country. What is it? This is occupied now by strangers, by foreigners. The ground here, this is our blood, that is us. And you could never fit into it. That's why you cannot appreciate the beauty of it. That's why you are destroying it.
That is Apache Indian medicine man Bernard Second, telling part of the story of his people today. For the Children's Foundation in Washington, D.C., this is Jeff Kamen reporting in Occupied Territory, the lives of Indians and Mexican Americans in the state of New Mexico. At the National Indian Youth Council's headquarters in Albuquerque, Sam English and Gerald Wilkinson are coordinating efforts aimed at organizing Indians into units of political power. I ask them to define what they see as the main barrier between Indians and dignity.
White people.
What do you mean when you say white people are the barrier?
Take a BIA agency office, the area office here in Albuquerque. I suppose a general idea ought to be that those people work for you. You know, you ought to have the freedom to roam, to ask people questions, relating to every, anything relating to Indians. But if an Indian walks in there, I think that the whole situation reverses, and you become scared. You know, you see, you walk in, and the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, you feel like Indians ought to be in control of that. Like the guy, sitting behind that big wooden desk ought to be an Indian or somebody, But it's not. You go talk to somebody, talk to a personnel officer, you go talk to anybody, I don't know, plant management or anything else, and there's always some white guy sitting behind some great big fancy desk, then you're scared to ask him questions.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems when you grow up in a situation where you have almost total outside control of everything that you do, anything you want, you must go to them, and so you get really kind of an inferiority complex in a lot of the Indian schools. If you enter an Indian school, they force you to choose a religion, either Catholic, Protestant, or Mormon. You don't have any choice about that.
What is it going to take before the power structure notices that the Indians really want change?
It might take a couple of uprisings. You may define them as being bloody rebellions. Well, we just define them as being bloody uprisings. And believe me, that's conceivable. That could happen, The Bureau could walk back, could come to work to one of their offices one of these days and find a damn thing burned down.
Indians living in New Mexico today find themselves confronted with hostile bureaucracies. The white-run Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, which employs Indians at substandard wages and working conditions. The police agencies, state, county, and local, which seem to take uniform delight in beating and humiliating Indians. And the state and county courts, which perform in such a fashion that some tribes have begun their own legal aid agencies to protect their members. What is even more destructive to the Indian, however, is his contact with the plastic world of the white man.
We will be right back with more Bozo Funnery after this word.
That is the sound of a TV set, a color TV set, in a recreation room for children on the Mescalero Apache Reservation. The kids come home from school every day and wrap themselves around the tube, the pool tables, and a jukebox filled with such Indian classics as Twist Again, Like We Did Last Summer. Apache medicine man Bernard Second is second by the policy of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which forces Indians to leave the reservation to go to school.
They leave the most important things in life. They leave their parents, and they leave their grandparents and their relatives, because all of them, not only the parents, but the grandparents and the relatives have a part, have every one of them have a little part in their upbringing. While they are growing into adulthood, they have a part in that, to teach them the right way, the way of the people. And when the white man takes them from them, from their relatives and their parents and great-grandparents, they have destroyed that all that they can get from them, because they have removed them from that. And when they're in the white man's world, the white man's world is a cold world. And automatically, just because of the coldness of that world, they turn off. And sure, they learn the mechanics of that world, But they are caught in the middle of two worlds, and they will eventually go back to where they came from. But it will be a long process, and they will bring more problems with them as they go back.
Many Indian children return from the federally run schools with deeply etched feelings of inferiority and rejection. The kids often begin their school experience with bright-eyed enthusiasm, only to emerge with the dull quiet of beaten people. It is common to hear white teachers say they purposely avoid learning about Indian culture because, after all, they are there to eradicate Indian ways and substitute white ones. At the Public Health Service Hospital in Gallup, New Mexico, a psychiatrist talks about the agony of dignity that Indians go through.
They find out that we don't respect them, and they find it out in a million ways, that white people simply don't respect Indians. It even comes through, I suppose, and maybe it hurts most then, from the white people who think that they really do respect and like Indians, and then they want to see them in war bonnets, or they want to see them do their charming, quaint things.
The Indian is first human. He, like you, becomes angry when abused.
The anger is directed not against the white man. That's both too frightening, and in some ways it goes against Navajo cultural traditions, I think. So that he's angry at himself, and that makes him depressed, or it makes him fail. One of the brightest young Navajo patients of mine came to me because he's always failing, and he's begun to realize that he fails for no good reason. He makes himself fail. Because to go on would get him into a position where he'd have to express his anger against white people.
The most dramatic demonstration of the Indian's inner-directed anger is the massive and self-destructive drinking that has become a basic part of life for Indians in New Mexico. Again, Apache medicine man Bernard Second.
My people were mighty people and proud people, but now, after the white man came, he lied to them with all the lies that they could give them. In return, they gave nothing to them. The only thing that they could give them was liquor. They give them liquor and the bad ways that they had. They gave it to the Indians. They gave it to my people. And now my people are bad because of that. Because they had no way of controlling that. Because we lived a good life, and we didn't have no such badness in our lives. But when the white man came, he brought those badness, and then he just warped our minds where we couldn't control the liquor. Now our people are killing each other.
At Eddie's Bar in Gallup, poverty-stricken Indians wearing cowboy-style clothing and sloshing beer and hard liquor down their mouths jam the airless dance floor and billiard room. It is to these sounds and the accompanying pressures of life in the brittle, cold white man's world that the original Americans drink their lives away. It is a ritual which before the white man was unknown to these children of the sun and the land and the rain. In Eddie's Bar one night, I met a 22-year-old Navajo who just completed a tour of duty in the Army overseas. At Eddie's 50 cents a beer price, the young man had little left of his separation check. If you listen closely to this great grandson of a proud warrior, you will hear all that needs to be said about Indians and liquor.
A lot of Indians hang around over here, you know, and get drunk every night, and that's what they do, and just hang around. A lot of guys get drunk. That's the way the Indians live over here in Gallup.
Do you live the same way?
Maybe I'll be living that way. No, I won't be. I don't know about that. I'll think about it when I finish when I get out now. I've been thinking about it.
No. Why do so many Indians live that way?
I can't understand why Indians live that way. I tell you true. I don't understand it.
Whose fault is it?
Well, I think that's their fault, is it? That's it.
Well, what about the white man? Isn't it his fault?
I don't think so. They don't. It's Indians' fault.
The alcoholism of that Indian is about as much his own fault as is the fate of the baby in this story from a physician who has devoted himself to serving the needs of the Navajo. The child in the story is a victim of the white politician's lack of concern.
I saw a child, a little Navajo child, come into the Gallup Indian Service Hospital 4 days after the mother had started out to bring him into the hospital. Many of the Navajos don't have transportation of any means. no car, only a horse. This mother wanted to bring her child in for mild diarrhea. And by the time the child arrived, it was severely dehydrated and died 2 days later.
At the Mescalero Apache Reservation, the sun was setting behind the Blue Mountains. Medicine man Bernard Second was talking.
You come here and you ask questions. And I pray for you, not because I want to demonstrate or anything, but to show you the way we think yet. See, the sun has gone down. The sun has gone down. It is going down, and may all the badness in life, may take it down with it. And tomorrow, when it comes up from this side, may bring only goodness to us. May bring only goodness for us, so that we can live in a good way. This is the way we pray in this world of troubled times. That's the only thing we can say. But see, this country here, when it belongs to us no more, when we are here no longer, then there will be no one here. Because when our blood cries from this land, no white man will live here in a happy way. They will only know a sad way, a sorrowful way, and they too will go. And then in some way, the clouds will come again, and the thunder will thunder again. And the rains will come, and the rainbows will shine, and the eagle will fly, and we will come again. One day we will become a mighty people again. I am not a dreamer. I'm a practical man with a practical religion that I have been taught by those from a long way back, long before the coming of the white man. And I have faith in what I believe in. Because if I didn't, I'd be like you. But I am not. I would never give up what I am for the hollow ways of white men. But now I smoke and drink for a little while, and then pretty soon I'll sing for you.
The medicine man then sang two holy songs that could not be recorded. They were songs of the sky and the sun and the land and the one without a name. Soon after, he consumed a dozen cans of beer and a quart of wine. He too was a victim of the occupation.
Wild child's in a world of trouble. Quiet child's in a world of pain. Lost child's in a world of sorrow. Searching children in a world of shame. Searching children in a world of shame.
Like the Indian in New Mexico, the Mexican-American, or Chicano, is also living in occupied territory. The first explorers to plant a European flag on the peaceful soil of the New World, their Spanish ancestors staked the first legal claim to the land. Spanish kings gave the land to loyal subjects. They, in turn, passed it on to their children. What is now New Mexico was once a part of Old Mexico, the rights to the land spelled out in grants dating back to the 16th century. Immediately after the war with Mexico, the land was taken in conquest by the United States. Then the cutthroat American businessmen, real estate sharks, moved in on the anxious owners of the soil. Through varying forms of business trickery, courtroom maneuvers, and government policies, the land of Mexican Americans was gradually gobbled up, stolen. The process is continuing today, and it is conceivable that one day soon, there will be no more land in the hands of the people who settled it first. Chicanos, Mexican Americans, are discriminated against in every area of life today. Police brutality is part of the ordinary expectation of Chicanos in New Mexico. Here, a husband and wife in their late 50s tell about being arrested along with their sons.
They took our sons in the cellar and they beat him up.
They got my bush against, you know, those steel walls and just beat them up.
They stopped the car and beat my boys up there.
They beat the, both of the boys inside the car on the way to jail.
In your presence?
Mm-hmm, in our presence. Mm-hmm.
What eventually did the court do about this? What was the court's decision?
They found us innocent.
The husband and wife had both been gainfully employed prior to the encounter with law and order. Following it, both were so badly shattered emotionally that the family was forced to go onto the welfare rolls. The total impact of the incident on the wife was all but paralyzing.
I couldn't even get out. I was afraid to go out. I was afraid that they might pick me up or something for nothing, you know what I mean. I even got afraid to go to the store, you know. I didn't feel free to, you know, to go and do errands or things like that.
Pete Domenici is the chairman of the Albuquerque City Commission, in effect, the mayor. It is Domenici's plan to become governor of New Mexico. I asked him about the people and the police.
I don't believe that police brutality exists in our city to any substantial degree. I'm ready to admit that any department of city government, just as any corporation or business with 450 employees, cannot in this day and age assume that every single apple is a good one.
Sadly, the problem goes far beyond apples or pears. It could develop into dramatic confrontation. Chicanos cannot find work when whites can. When they do, they are paid less. They are badly treated by the welfare system. And even the federally financed war on poverty has been rigged against them. Local agencies of the Office of Economic Opportunity are always run by Chicanos, who must report to Anglos, to whites. So jealous of their petty power are the Chicano agency directors that they generally contribute to an environment of distrust that exists almost throughout the Mexican-American community.
Since I was in kindergarten, we've been just kind of self-taught, not just by ourselves, but by our educators and somewhat by our parents, and not to trust each other. Just plain being Chicanos, not to trust each other, you know, because I don't know why, but they just were. They just, and it just is that way.
The clear-cut racial discrimination against Chicanos in New Mexico extends deep into the public school system. This boy is 16.
One day, there was a fight between my friend and some other boys, and there was quite a lot. I came to help him, and he called in just these boys and my friend and myself, and he asked us what the controversy was, and he says that, well, I told him that, well, these boys are picking on my friend, and I came to help him. And he asked these boys, and they were Anglo guys, and he asked them, well, this is true, and he says, no. And so he sent these boys away, and he expelled my friend and me.
When welfare worker Maria Duran tried to organize welfare recipients for the protection of their rights under the law, she was quickly removed from her job and blacklisted. Today, she is on welfare.
Some women even turn into prostitutes. They don't want to do it, but when you have 10 kids, 8 kids, and your husband can't come back to live with you, you can have your boyfriend at home, but you can't have your husband. And that's the stupidest thing I ever seen. And or she either steals or she gets away. I mean, this is very, I mean, I can hardly express it or explain it. You see, a woman, especially a Chicana, a minority, well, any woman, well, I'm going to say about myself, when you have your kid, your kids mean everything to you, and you do anything for them kids, and if you don't have enough money, you're going to go get it. It doesn't matter. Even if you don't eat, as long as the kids have food and clothing and a roof over their heads, you're going to get it. So when a woman gets a job, she'll do anything to get that job. Even if she has to go to bed with the owner of the place where she gets a job, and that's another thing that's happening here in New Mexico, too. And she doesn't want to be on welfare, so she gets a job. So she has to be a mistress of whoever owns the place.
The system is so tough on Chicanos that many of these formerly honorable and honest people turn to crime. As a matter of fact, it is only within the walls of the county prison in Albuquerque that the Chicano is in control. There he dramatically outnumbers Anglos, and his jailers are afraid of him. A young Anglo who spent time in that jail talks about Chicano prisoners.
They all were good people, and I felt sorry for them, you know. But actually, what it was, they were just trying to help themselves, you know, burglarizing for money, you know, their kids be hungry, and peddling dope mostly, and actually, none of them were professionals. I mean, they really didn't know what they're doing, or else, you know, they wouldn't get caught so much, you know. They were just go out and hit a place and get caught and go to jail and spend 5 years and come out and they get desperate again, do the same thing over again.
Just outside the city limits of Albuquerque, there are people who pay their taxes but don't even get clean water.
Oh, it's the worst. We can use it to drink it or to take a bath. It's real bad.
Why is it bad?
They got soap or something, you know. They
it's contaminated.
Yeah, they got a, it's a real stick, you know. And we can use it for to drink, just to wash dishes and use it for home.
What do you do for water then?
At Mrs. Chavez, we used to bring the water at 4th Street.
How far away is that?
It's about 2 miles.
You had to carry the water that you were going to drink or bathe in for 2 miles?
Yes.
How often did you have to do that?
Well, every 2 days. Sometimes, and sometimes every day.
Were you actually drinking the dirty water before you knew it was bad?
I started to drink it about a week, you know, and I started to get sick. And I went to a doctor, and then the doctor told me to not drink the water, and we started to drink it from there.
And how long has the water been bad?
Since we moved here. Since 1950.
20 years.
Mm-hmm.
The lady's husband suffered a form of paralysis and a discoloration of the skin, all as a result of drinking the water. The community worker who brought in fresh water for the people got in trouble with his bosses and almost got fired for trying to help the poor. Like the Indians, the Chicanos have discovered that white people, Anglos, simply don't respect them, not even their right to the most fundamental human dignity. Here, an angry social worker tells of a plot to sterilize the mother of 16 children.
Several attempts were made to bring the lady into the hospital so that she would, so a hysterectomy could be performed on her, thereby alleviating her from, I guess, the process of rearing any more children. This was contrary to her beliefs, and it upset her greatly, and there were several attempts made, and each time that she was picked up, she was very reluctant and didn't abide by it, and in turn, this has caused a great deal of distress on her part, and she will have nothing to do with any agency. The younger ones are approached with a method of Planned Parenthood contraceptives in the forms of pill, or you know, taken orally, and all sorts of things. Other measures too are used, but she is definitely not alone.
Did the agencies of the Anglo establishment try any halfway measures on this woman?
The doctors at a center inserted a coil known as some sort of a contraceptive device in her without her being aware of what was going on.
About 2 years ago, a group of militant Chicanos, calling themselves the Brown Berets, came to the surface in New Mexico. Like the Black Panthers, these Mexican-Americans talked about picking up the gun to do combat with injustice. Like the Panthers, their leadership was quickly attacked by the establishment. Today, the Brown Berets are quietly at work, organizing in the barrios, the little Chicano ghettos of New Mexico. Some of the Brown Berets have enlisted in the armed forces, not to serve the United States, but to learn how to use the gun. If social conditions don't change dramatically in New Mexico soon, the Brown Berets will surely win tremendous support.
Wild child's in a world of trouble now.
This program was produced by the Children's Foundation in Washington, D.C.
Wild child's in a world of trouble now.
This is Jeff Kamen speaking.
Wild child's